1865, dire questions remained. Could at long last those national walls be erected to support the constitutional roof? And could a now bloody, exhausted, embittered America survive as one country? The dismal examples from the rest of the world were not encouraging. To the South, the Latin American wars for independence had produced not one, not two, but some 22 separate nations from a few vice-royalties. With bewildering rapidity, these republics came and went, trapped for decades in a vortex of conflict and military repression. Nor was this simply a Latin American trait. Across the Atlantic loomed the specter of the French Revolution, the terror, the contagion, occurring as it did in the most advanced country of the day. France had been the epicenter of the Enlightenment. Its science led the world. Its books were read everywhere. Madison had Jefferson. Then the minister to France sent him $220 worth of books on government and philosophy to read as the founders undertook to craft the Constitution. Its language was the tongue of aristocracies, and it was the most powerful country in all of Europe, if not the world. Yet revolution plunged France, and in time all of Europe, into an ongoing cycle of terror and violence, the remnants of which plagued the continent for decades like a recurring nightmare. No country was totally immune, from Denmark to Sicily, from Bohemia to Hungary. And the problems of France and Europe in many ways resembled those of the United States. The fundamental question of nations and nationalities, the task of bringing the people into some kind of rational relationship with their governments and some form of mutual and moral relationship with their sovereign states. The founders themselves were acutely aware of all this. Indeed, they were haunted by it. The horror of France was anticipated even in the very design of the capital city, Washington itself. Rejecting the plan to lay out the city in elegant rectangular blocks and eye-catching right angles as in Philadelphia, the designers ultimately employed the radial plan, filled with ronds-points, or circles. In their conception and execution, these circles were to provide stations for armed soldiers, allowing them to maintain full command of the streets in case of any popular civil uprising or prolonged mob violence. Unlike in France, there should be no barricades in Washington. But the Civil War threatened to take the United States down a very different sort of road. As the European and Latin American examples glumly proved, it was not solely a matter of whether the North or the South won the war. As critical was the delicate matter of how the war would end, and how the peace would be made. Would the country emerge united, one nation, Abraham Lincoln's fervent dream? Or would it remain fragmented, ever ready to disintegrate into petty, squabbling, minor or fragmented republics, or become chronically vulnerable to anarchy or low-level violence, as was the dismal fate of many of America's European friends and Central American neighbors, and more generally, of other republics throughout history, and even in our own most recent century. The Civil War, then, in its final months, was more than a struggle for the soul of America, or the survival of the Republican experiment. It was a larger fight once and for all to construct the nation. It was in April 1865 that the outlines of the answer to this question would finally appear with clarity. As spring crept north across Virginia in 1865, Monticello, like America itself, now seemed more a monument to folly than a measure of grand design, more a finite experiment than a creation that could endure. Like so much of the country, it sat, rather uneasily, in no man's land. It was a house with two competing owners, one northern, the estate of naval officer Uriah Levy, one southern, the Confederate entrepreneur Benjamin Franklin. It was a home with two competing souls, John Winthrop's City Upon a Hill, and Thomas Jefferson's Declaration of Independence. And it was an estate with two diametric visages, one the best of America, the shining ideal of equality, one the darkest, the specter of slavery. But in a curious, deeply symbolic way, and despite all the neglect, it stubbornly remained a provocative reminder of the spirit of the elusive nation, as a shrine, not entirely Southern or really Yankee, a place where visitors still came to pay tribute to Jefferson, and where people could recall the moral imperatives and sense of high purpose that had once seemed so clear and compelling to the founders. And come they did, even in the Civil War, even on the eve of April 1865. Indeed, as the crisis of the Civil War intensified, Monticello was frequently the tranquil eye in the hurricane. Confederate troops had overrun it in 1862, but they were content to leave it in the hands of the old caretaker, Joseph Wheeler. No significant battles took place near Jefferson's Mountain. When Confederate John Bell Hood's Texas Brigade did pass through, they stood reverently on the front porch, the sacred portals, and mused about the famous statesman and his glorious memories. Over the next 2 years, on sunny days under the velvety sky, a few picnics were held on Monticello's lawns. On one bright autumn day in the fall of 1863, some convalescing Confederate soldiers even held a day of gaiety, a mock tournament of knights, most riding with only one arm, reins held in the teeth, dashing valiantly at the rings with wooden sticks employed as lances. Periodically, Northerners came too. Mostly visitors, wherever they came from, ended up in the great dome room. Almost unused in Jefferson's day, it now boasted more than 1,000 of their names written on its walls. And while they left their signatures, bold or hesitant, many took away something else. Year by year, they chipped and chiseled away at Jefferson's tombstone, a 5-foot memorial that, upon his wishes, simply enshrined him not as president, but as the author of the Declaration of Independence. In drawers and keepsake boxes and on parlor tables, they preserved these pieces, as if there was something worth saving of the man and the country he had helped to create. But as April 1865 approached, what would ultimately be saved, if anything, depended on a handful of men, one of whom was readying to take his place upon an inaugural podium in the Union Capitol of Washington, D.C., and another of whom was urgently riding into the Confederate capital of Richmond, Virginia. Part 1, March 1865. Chapter 1, The Dilemma. The bells rang that day in Washington. Wherever there were brick bell towers and whitewashed churches, wherever rows of bells hung in ascending niches, wherever the common people could crowd belfries to take turns pulling the ropes, the bells sang. Bells were part of the American tradition. Cast in iron, bronze, copper, and sometimes silver, they rang with 100 messages, summoning Americans to Sunday services, marking the harvest and holidays, signaling the prosperity of planting, tolling the sadness of death, chiming the happiness of marriage, clanging warnings of fire or flood, or booming out the celebration of victory. Today, they rang with a hint of promise. It was March 4, 1865, Inauguration Day in the Union. Abraham Lincoln had been at the Capitol since mid-morning, foregoing a traditional celebratory carriage ride up Pennsylvania Avenue to sign a stack of bills passed in the waning hours of the lame duck Congress. He was determined to make his own mark on them before the vice presidential swearing-in, scheduled for noon. Cloistered in the Senate wing, tracing and retracing the letters of his name, Lincoln remained the very picture of exhaustion. His face was heavily lined, his cheeks were sunken, and he had lost 30 pounds in recent months. Though only 56, he could easily pass for a very old man. He was sick, dispirited, and even his hands were routinely cold and clammy. And today, the weather itself seemed to be colluding with his foul and melancholy mood. That morning, heavy clouds moved over Washington as they had the day before and the day before that, whipping the Capitol with blasts of rain and wind. Even when the rain let up, the ground didn't. The streets were a sea of mud at least 10 inches deep. Still, the people came. On the following Monday, the inauguration rush would include a grand ball for 4,000. They would waltz and polka to the beat of a military band, feast on an elegant medley of beef, veal, poultry, game, smoked meats, terrapin, oysters, and salads, finish with an astounding wartime array of ices, tarts, cakes, fruits, and nuts, and then retire for the evening with steaming coffee and good rich chocolate. But that was for official Washington, for Lincoln's Loyalists and Republican Party functionaries. This Saturday was a day for all the Union, and like a great herd, the people were seemingly everywhere. Their wagons ground to a halt underneath thickets of trees in the distance, and the thud and swish of their feet could be heard along Pierre Lafont's wide, radiating avenues. All along Pennsylvania Avenue they converged, where the crowd stood at least 6 and 8 deep on the crude sidewalks. Around 15th Street, past the Treasury, where the stars and stripes hung from second-story windows, past Kirkland House and 10th Street and the National Hotel, where a clutch of handkerchiefs fluttered and gawkers hung out their balconies, and up the steep slope to the Capitol, past the greening swatch of emerald lawns. At street intersections, military patrols formed a watchful guard. So did the Capitol Police. Reporters and photographers crowded the stoops, ready to record the event for posterity. Flags waved, people cheered, and the band played. But mostly, the vast throng jostled for position by the east facade of the Capitol, newly capped by its gleaming dome and the towering bronze Statue of Freedom, to be near, even to catch a glimpse of the president himself. Finally, the presidential party moved from the Senate chamber out onto the platform. A roar of applause arose from the crowd as Lincoln made his way to a seat. It dipped and then mounted again as the sergeant-at-arms beckoned, and Lincoln stood, towering over the other men, and made his way to the podium. As Lincoln rose and moved forward, a blazing sun broke through the gray haze and flooded the entire gathering with brilliant light. Above and below, the collective pulse quickened. "Did you notice that sunburst?" the president later said. "It made my heart jump." But whatever ominous portent that moment may have held, it was overshadowed by the more powerful drama of Lincoln's speech. Succinct, only 703 words, eloquent and memorable, it was reminiscent of the Gettysburg Address, and at this crucial stage of the war every bit as important. Summoning his waning energies, Lincoln began to read. As he rode into Richmond, Virginia, on that very same March morning, Robert E. Lee was met with none of the same fanfare. Slipping north from the trench lines ringing Petersburg, he must have felt that on this particular day, Union troops would have been loath to undertake any action. But he had a far more specific reason for journeying to the Confederate capital. Today, he harbored a single daring plan to reignite the waning fortunes of the Confederacy, to somehow push the 11 states toward eventual independence. And he had come to confer with Confederate President Jefferson Davis, the insomniac head of the Southern government who liked to wage war from his dining room, with maps unfurled and instruments scattered across the table. Lee's ultimate calculation was as bold as it was simple. Abandon Richmond and take his forces south to meet up with General Joe Johnston in North Carolina. Leave U.S. Grant snugly ensconced in a City Point camp, holding the bag minus the string. From there, they could continue the war indefinitely. In the early pre-dawn hours, Lee had already vetted his options with General John B. Gordon, a shrewd, able warrior and one of his most trusted lieutenants. That meeting had proved to be an eye-opener. A Confederate courier, sent by Lee, had roused Gordon sometime around midnight, and it took the 33-year-old 2 hours of hard riding and a bitter chill to reach the commanding general at his Edge Hill headquarters outside Petersburg. There, as Union troops slumbered and Washington celebrated, Gordon found Lee surrounded by a long table strewn with recent reports from every part of the army. One by one, Lee handed Gordon the papers to read. Lee, his face tight, already knew what was in them. Despite a score of earlier tactical successes, the news was dismal. For 9 months now, Lee's men had been living in a 37-mile labyrinth of trenches, stretching east of Richmond and southwest of Petersburg. 3 times in July and September and again in October, Grant had hurled his troops at Lee's Army of Northern Virginia, only to have them repulsed. In one instance, the Battle of the Crater, it was an outright disaster for the Federals. What Grant had hoped in the early spring of 1864 would have become a quick war of maneuver, open battle, and offense had instead become a prolonged siege. One surreal month after another, the two exhausted armies shadowboxed from their trenches. Throughout the summer and fall, the earthworks reverberated with abrupt, all-out attempts to break Lee's lines, sudden, unexpected death, and round-the-clock sharpshooting. This pendulum of harassment was punctuated only by the tedium of the siege, which was hardly any more palatable. As winter set in, the coldest in memory, Lee feared that unless his thinly stretched lines could be reinforced, a great calamity will befall us. Actually, The first great calamity was the plight of the men themselves. Despite Lee's efforts to secure food and clothing for his army, little was available. Scurvy, dysentery, and night blindness invaded the Confederate trenches. Simple cuts and small wounds refused to heal. The men lived with rats and lice amid the stench of urine, feces, even decaying flesh, staring up at the sky by day and often venturing out only by night. Morale plummeted. Eventually, driven by extreme hunger, assaulted by the biting cold, torn by letters from wives that movingly spoke of starvation and loss at home, deserters mushroomed, reaching 100 a day during the severe freeze of February. His hands tied, at one point Lee exploded to his son Custis, "I have been up to see the Congress, and they don't seem to be able to do anything except to eat peanuts and chew tobacco, while my army is starving." When the long, low fever of the Virginia winter finally abated, the situation for Lee's men was no less desperate. Day after day, silence was punctured by the sporadic signs of war, billowing clouds of dense, roiling smoke, stabbing spurts of gunfire, the steady roar of bursting shells, scattered debris that heaved and shifted with each hit, and disemboweled corpses flying upward and out of the trenches. This Lee could live with. But as he shuffled field report after report in his headquarters at Edge Hill in early March, what now struck Lee was the destitution of his beloved army. There were no shoes, no overcoats, no blankets, and little food. Men scrambled between the legs of horses for dung to sift for undigested corn. There was insanity, exhaustion, wounds gone gangrenous, and of course, there was Grant. At the most, Lee now had 57,000 men in his army. Fewer than 35,000 were present for duty. Grant had, he believed, 150,000. Once reinforced by Sherman from the south and Sheridan from the west, Lee feared the Union commander would have 280,000. His calculations were not far off the mark. The Union had near endless resources, although not always the will to use them. As the minutes had ticked by that evening at Edge Hill, and after Gordon had read the reports, Lee had asked him for his options. Gordon reluctantly concluded that there were three. Make peace between the two sides on the best possible terms. Retreat and join General Joe Johnston's forces in North Carolina. Or stand and fight where they were. Of the three, retreat and peace were the most promising ones. Lee agreed. But as he set out for Richmond after that largely sleepless night, the peace option had already been foreclosed. Peace feelers had been tried twice that year, their first culminating in a full-fledged conference on U.S. Grant's steamer, the River Queen, anchored off Hampton Roads. There, Lincoln and his Secretary of State, William Seward, had met with the diminutive Confederate Vice President, Alexander Stevens, and two other Confederate representatives. Ironically, it was the Northerners who had offered the South drastic concessions on slavery and immediate emancipation, but to the Confederates, their remaining terms smacked of unconditional surrender. Stevens, who had served with Lincoln in Congress and appeared as small and misshapen, as Lincoln did large and gangly, said, "Mr. President, if we understand you correctly, you think that we of the Confederacy have committed treason, that we are traitors to your government, that we have forfeited our rights and our proper subjects for the hangman." Lincoln in turn responded, "Yes, that is about the size of it." The second feeler had come from Confederate General James Longstreet and Union General Edward Ord. They had proposed a meeting of generals, led by Grant and Lee, to come together as former comrades and friends and talk a little. Lee had conferred with Davis and subsequently sent a note to Grant offering to meet. Grant had wired Lincoln regarding the plan on March 3rd, exactly 1 month to the day after the failed Hampton Roads conference, and Lincoln had wasted no time in killing this new one. "No meeting," he chided, "unless it be for the capitulation of General Lee's army." So, on that March Saturday, as an exhausted and careworn Lincoln took to the podium in Washington and a baggy-eyed Lee trotted through the streets of Richmond, peace looked quite dead indeed. The Abraham Lincoln, who gazed out at the inaugural crowd stretching before him, was a distinctly complex and often deeply conflicted man. Complex because the man who had pledged the previous summer in Philadelphia that the war would not end until its worthy object was attained, and, "Under God, I hope it will never end until that time," had returned from Hampton Roads in February and suggested to his cabinet that the United States pay the insurgent southern states $400 million, as compensation for their lost slaves if they surrendered by April 1. The Union cabinet was unanimous in its rejection and conflicted because the man who had affixed his name to the unequivocal words of the Emancipation Proclamation had also offered the Southerners the carrot of compensated and even delayed emancipation at that meeting if they would only return to the Union. Now, on this newly minted afternoon, Lincoln seemed to need the power and the firmness of his chosen words as much as did the anxious audience standing before him, or as did the larger expectant Union nation. When he started to read from a single sheet of paper printed in two broad columns, the crowd pressed forward slightly to catch every word. When he spoke, they nodded in silent affirmation. When he addressed his larger themes, they listened with deference, even awe. When he truly touched them, they burst into applause and even tears. Notably lacking from his speech, however, was any stinging attribution of blame for the war. All dreaded it, his voice rang out, and all sought to avert it. But one of the parties to the conflict would make war rather than let the nation survive, and the other would accept war rather than let it perish. And the war came. Strangely lacking, too, from the speech, after his brief first paragraph, was a reference to anything that he had said and done during the previous 4 years. His goal today was not to take political credit or to assign blame, but to send a heartfelt message to the Union and the Confederacy alike. Neither side had expected the war to last as long or grow to such magnitude as it had, he had observed philosophically. Each looked for an easier triumph, and a result less fundamental and astounding. Both read the same Bible and pray to the same God, and each invokes his aid against the other. On the matter of slavery, he reproached but absolved the South of the ultimate blame. It may seem strange that any men should dare to ask God's assistance in wringing their bread from the sweat of other men's faces, but let us judge not that we be judged. What was the war's cause? Somehow, he suggested, it was slavery. And how long would the war last? The question that was foremost on everyone's mind. Here Lincoln wearily made no pledge. Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war might speedily pass away. At the same time, he left no doubt of his intention to fight on, if God wills that it continue, until slavery was crushed and the Union was permanently reunited. He saved his most soaring and trenchant words for the conclusion, the true heart and the indelible spirit of his speech. With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right, let us strive to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations. Lincoln then turned to Chief Justice Salmon Chase, soberly took the oath of office, and ended with an emphatic, "So help me God." Bowing his head, he kissed an open Bible, and then as he bowed again to the cheering assembly, an artillery salvo exploded in the wind. The Confederate White House stood several blocks from the state capitol. It was not designed as a public building, but rather came into being as the private home of a wealthy Richmonder, who had installed it in the mid-19th century miracles of gas lamps and crude but serviceable plumbing. When the war came, he offered his house for the new Confederate president, replete with its flat front and rear-facing porch, designed to protect the family from the dust and mud and pungent smells of the street. But he was also something of a prudent patriot. In a revealing bit of symbolism, he sold his home to the established city of Richmond and not to the fledgling Confederate nation. Its current occupant, however, harbored no such qualms about the Confederate cause. Jefferson Davis had used the failure of the Hampton Roads Peace Conference to rejuvenate Southern pride and nationalistic ardor, and the people had rallied accordingly from Richmond and Mobile, from Lynchburg and Raleigh, and other cities across the Confederacy. One by one, once passionate critics had also risen up in support of Jeff Davis and the cause. So, while resources were running scarce, will was for the moment growing stronger. New appointments, most notably Robert E. Lee's recent promotion to commander of all the armies, and administrative changes had also led Southerners to believe again that the war's tide might yet turn. And everyone knew that the Robert E. Lee who came to Richmond that March morning was not simply the man who commanded an army of men pinned down in their trenches, but was a Southern general who had driven McClellan off the peninsula, stopped Pope at Second Manassas, hoodwinked Burnside at Fredericksburg, destroyed Hooker at Chancellorsville, and thwarted Grant in the Wilderness, all against overwhelming odds. And while Lee himself understood that the Confederate hegira was at a turning point, perhaps even nearing the end, the Southern General-in-Chief still harbored hopes of staving off disaster. This was, of course, vintage Lee, ever bold and invariably aggressive. Now, meeting with Jefferson Davis as Lincoln spoke of malice toward none and charity for all, the two discussed the Confederacy's options. Peace between the two countries was dead. But another option loomed. Withdraw from Richmond, retreat south, and join Joe Johnston's army and strike hard at Union General William Tecumseh Sherman. Lee would have to make the most out of this opportunity. But he also believed that he could rely on the unparalleled endurance of his men, their loyalty, their fight, their overwhelming will in the face of the worst privations. In fact, this was also the opportunity he had long been waiting for. For some time, the commanding general had wanted to be free of Richmond. In January, Lee had secretly told congressional questioners that the military evacuation of Richmond would actually make him stronger than before. Richmond's fall, he confided, from a moral and political viewpoint, might be a serious calamity, but once it happened, he could prolong the war for a good 2 more years on Virginia soil. In truth, since the war began, precisely because Lee had been saddled with vigorously defending the nation's capital, he had been forced to let the enemy make strategic plans for him, to dictate far too much of the course of battle, and to determine the pace and time of combat. But, he added, striking a more hopeful pose, when Richmond falls, I shall be able to make them for myself. To Lee, one of the most daring and offensive-minded of generals, a war of attrition had always favored the North. As a strategist, Lee chafed under the yoke of defensive tactics. We must strike them, he had lamented. We must never let them pass us again. We must strike them a blow. Yet Lee also knew the harsh reality of the arithmetic of war. He no longer had any men to spare. If it becomes a siege, he had gravely told his general Jubal Early, then it is just a matter of time. At last, the time had come for Lee to make his own plans. Davis listened and did not flinch. Why not withdraw at once? He countered. Lee explained that the army's horses were too weak to pull the guns and wagons through the thick March mud. But in 2 or 3 weeks, the roads would be passable. Then he could make his move. In the meantime, he would make the necessary arrangements. And here the matter lay, with Robert E. Lee at 58, an imposing figure with a strikingly dignified face and an honorable pedigree, who could endure disappointment and frustration with stoic reserve, but who would not accept defeat. And with Jefferson Davis, the austere, ascetic, grim-faced, and obdurate Confederate president, the once poignant nationalist and unremitting Unionist, who now lived for Southern independence, that and seemingly little more. They, every bit as much as Richmond, were the polar stars of the Confederacy, its very embodiment. And on this fateful day, their decision was made. With this new strategy in mind, they would continue to fight with everything they had. In Lee's words, they would fight to the last. Under the jubilant eyes of Frederick Douglass, who would be ushered into the White House later that evening at the request of Lincoln himself, becoming the first black man to be officially received in the nation's home, and under the watchful gaze of the dashing young actor John Wilkes Booth, who occupied a prime spot in the balcony above the president, Abraham Lincoln had formally begun his second term. Now he had both a war to win and a nation's wounds to bind. To some, like his congressional critics, these two elusive goals may have been flagrant contradictions. But to Lincoln, they were nothing less than the bedrock of his policies, the true, indefinable purpose of this war. There were, he knew, some propitious signs that the national bloodbath was moving toward its preordained conclusion. In February, Sherman's army had driven into South Carolina like a tribe of thundering Mongols. And South Carolina, the queen state of Dixie, where the nightmare of secession and rebellion had begun, quickly fell. Civilians deserted their houses and fled their cities before Sherman's approaching hordes. Then Columbia, the state's capital, lay in flames, incinerated, a smoking ruin, the victim of Sherman's men and chaos. Meanwhile, in the breadbasket of the Confederacy, the Shenandoah, Union General Phil Sheridan had cut a channel of destruction, wide and long, straight to the Rapidan River. And Grant's mighty Army of the Potomac was hunkered down around Petersburg, ready to drive into the heart of the Confederacy, into Richmond, into Robert E. Lee's vaunted Army of Northern Virginia itself. But there were also reasons why Abraham Lincoln was the most tired man in the world. For nearly every Union success, he could still count a time when Lee had been within their grasp and yet eluded his generals. McDowell, McClellan, Meade, Pope, Burnside, Hooker, each foiled. And Grant, too, decried as a butcher, sending the boys in blue into rebel range like cattle to a slaughter, mauled in the wilderness and now pinned down in Petersburg. Certainly there were, as Lincoln was well aware, indications that the Southern will to fight was waning, that the Confederacy was slowly coming to pieces. But there were also indications that the war could drag on for at least 3 more months of murderous fighting, perhaps even for another entire year, and, he bristled, how much more could the country take? And then finally, for Lincoln there was the unthinkable. The specter of Lee and his men slipping into the western mountains to wage a prolonged campaign of harassment. As much as any other scenario, this was now his greatest fear. The glory of a restored Union, he believed, must be built on more than butchery, revenge, and retribution. So, in the spring of 1865, this then was his dilemma. The exigencies of the total war that he was waging against the requirements of reunification in the peace that he hoped to make. Never were two goals more incompatible. Lincoln was so exhausted after the inauguration ceremonies that he took to his bed for several days. By March 14th, he would feel so ill that he would conduct a cabinet meeting in his bedroom. In the weeks that followed, Lee refined his audacious plan. As soon as the opportunity presented itself, he would attack Grant's lines below the Appomattox River, seeking to disrupt and disorient the Union commander. In turn, that would free a portion of his troops to quickly join Johnston and later to strike at Sherman. If his offensive failed, he would then abandon Richmond and Petersburg altogether, joining Johnston with his entire army. After a lightning march, he would hope to smash Sherman and then do what he did best, contest Grant in a prolonged war of maneuver. As the first hint of spring crept into Virginia, Lee's strategy had crystallized. After months of stalemate and tense confrontation, he had settled upon this. Shock Grant with a sudden assault on Fort Stedman, a federal strong point just east of Petersburg. To be sure, given the tattered state of his troops, it was a daring act. But then again, Lee was always at his best when he was daring. His spirits would brighten, his deep black eyes would glow, his carefully cultivated control would give way to a flicker of emotion. Though federal forces outnumbered the Confederates by more than 3-1, Lee had repeatedly demonstrated that his men could overcome far larger numbers. Though his army was ragged and exhausted, he would rally it. And though he was a consummate military realist, he was also possessed by a rare compass, a gambler's sense that military miracles were not to be mocked or eschewed. History had turned on a dime countless times before. So it could again. The attack on Fort Stedman, employing deception, secrecy, surprise, would take place on March 25th. It would be one of the most intricate and brazen assaults of the war. If successful, some believed, it would open up a corridor all the way to Grant's headquarters at City Point. If the capture of Fort Stedman was a hope, the abandonment of Richmond was now a certainty, its fate having been sealed along with Lee's plans. Yet Lee's plans, of course, beg the question, what about Richmond? To be sure, if ever there was a capital to be hesitantly relinquished by the Confederates, and at the same time to be eagerly prized by the Union, it was Richmond. From its earliest years, Richmond had been a city of opposites, simultaneously genteel and seething. It seemed to be a magnet for uprisings, either igniting them or squelching them. Before there was ever a city named Richmond, it was here, along the banks of the James, that Nathaniel Bacon had settled on a spit of land and in 1676 started the revolt that would carry his name. It was here, in St. John's Church, that another proud son of Virginia, Patrick Henry, lit an inchoate country on fire, exhorting rebellion in 1775 when he declared, "Give me liberty or give me death," as Thomas Jefferson in the audience watched on. It was also here in 1800 that the slave Gabriel Prosser staged, ultimately in vain, a widespread black insurrection. And it was here, in 1832, that the House of Delegates shook a nation, hotly debating a bill to end slavery in Virginia, only to have it lose by 7 votes, and in a tragic twist to have the state convention end by further tightening the shackles of bondage. But the divided nature of Richmonders also went only so far. For the most part, Richmonders were scions of the legacy of the first settlers in America, the 105 men and boys who landed in 1607 along the broad sweep at Cape Henry on the Virginia coast. Arriving aboard the Sarah Constant, the Godspeed, and the Discovery, they had already braved harsh howling winds, mighty gales, and turbulent seas. Now they anchored amid the uncertainty of a new land, cast in a sturdy English empirical mode of fair-mindedness, united by a common desire to better themselves financially and socially. They were largely a moderate people, wedded to the rites of hierarchy and patriarchy, pragmatic, and deeply steeped in tradition. One of those traditions, of course, was governance. As early as 1619, the first colonists had set up a miniature parliament when they debated the Dales Code. Within a decade, sweating and stewing and battling flies, they had already developed a highly impressive legislative machinery, establishing the House of Burgesses, the first representative body in the New World. More than a century later, by the time the state capital was moved to Richmond in 1780, Richmonders had been proudly and defiantly rooted in the exercise of popular will and the rancorous give-and-take of democracy. In no small measure, they had helped to invent it. As the capital of Virginia, Richmond also had a heritage of leadership unmatched on either side of the Potomac. It rightly laid claim to being the seat of the great Virginia dynasty, to being the capital of the mother of states and statesmen, and to being the cradle of democracy. It proudly boasted the authors of the Declaration of Independence and of the Constitution, and it justly claimed America's first president. No one cherished the tenets of Republican liberty more than Richmonders. To the extent that Richmonders were inclined to view Virginia first and foremost as their country, and they did, it was also true that no one was more fervent in the defense of Union in the first years of the new American Republic. Indeed, in 1812, when New England Federalists were threatening secession, it was Thomas Ritchie of the Richmond Inquirer who alone unleashed the most stinging criticisms, denouncing the disloyal elements who would dash to pieces the holy ark of the Union of our country. In the years leading up to the Civil War, Richmonders built a stunning city, a thriving hybrid of old-fashioned Southern gentility and newfangled urban enterprise. Day to day, Richmond was undergirded by a sharply drawn social structure, an overlay of the old Virginia gentry, an assortment of newcomers, working-class immigrants, Germans, Irishmen, and Jews, and a foundation of free blacks and black slavery. But cast among its 7 picturesque hills, this urban enterprise hummed with a remarkable vibrancy. Richmond and the suburbs were studded with handsome parks, grassy residential squares, tree-lined avenues, and imposing statues. Red brick townhouses ranged in long rows on Marshall, Carey, and Franklin streets, their russet facades displaying a pleasing symmetry. Above, atop the hills, were mansions, belonging not just to genuine aristocrats but also to much of the new wealth, the prosperous bankers, the merchants, and the industrialists, who were vying with the planters for supremacy in the city. Down by the waterfront, the James River teemed with coastal and ocean-going vessels, ships that traded not only with the countryside in the north, but halfway across the world, with Britain and even the far corners of continental Europe. Meanwhile, day in and day out, the Tredegar Iron Works spewed black smoke. Richmond had the largest iron industry in all of Dixie. And looming over it all was the classical splendor of the Capitol building, designed by Jefferson, the elegant governor's mansion, the beautiful city hall, and the intricate landscaping of Capitol Square. By 1859, with its population of almost 40,000, Richmond was not the largest city in the South. Slightly smaller than Charleston, it had less than a quarter of New Orleans' population and even ranked behind Louisville, Kentucky. But it was surely unique. Unlike the Deep South, it was distinctly more diverse. With its commitment to public education, it had 6 public schools as well as a college for women. With its commitment to religious pluralism, it had 33 Protestant churches that were complemented by 3 Jewish synagogues, three Roman Catholic churches, a Quaker meeting house, and a Universalist church. With its four newspapers jockeying for attention, its political voice was often broad and remarkably lively. Not surprisingly, as the war came, few doubted that the city was anything but an impressive blend of rural provincialism and urban potential. Its atmosphere of high breeding and noblesse oblige made it distinctly southern, but its diverse economy, heterogeneous population, and moderate outlook gave it a lusty cosmopolitan air that solidly fastened it in the mold of the larger United States, unusual in the antebellum South. And, in a young country still very much struggling with its national identity, Richmond, and Richmond alone among the great cities, could bask in the golden age of Washington, Jefferson, Monroe, and Madison, making it a trenchant portrait of the young American Republic. But when the guns of Fort Sumter sounded on April 12, 1861, and the North-South Divide could no longer be papered over, the city was immediately transformed, siding with its longer southern roots. Having helped create the United States, it would now look to dissolve them. With flushed faces, wild eyes, screaming mouths, and jubilant demonstrations, Richmonders chose the Confederacy, and in turn, the Confederate States of America soon made Richmond the capital of their new nation. It was a fateful decision. With the benefit of more than a century of hindsight, it is easy to doubt the wisdom of locating the Confederacy's capital in Richmond. For one thing, it was a strategic gamble, boldly putting the capital within ready striking distance of the Union. Accessible by water and only 100 miles from Washington, it was especially vulnerable, and on the fringe of the new nation rather than at its center, it would have great difficulty extending its power over the vast hinterland of the huge 11-state Confederacy. But in the end, when the war came, the southern politicians rapidly tired of Montgomery, Alabama, the site of the first Confederate capital, with its clouds of mosquitoes and its pitiful facilities. After some to and fro, Richmond was the logical, if not the only, choice. The significance of this decision was not lost on the North. As quickly as July 21, 1861, Union soldiers under General Irvin McDowell marched southward to the cry, "On to Richmond!" This was but the first of six massive offenses waged against the rebel capital. And from then on, Richmond would live under the menacing scythe of Union attack. 60% of the war would be fought on Virginia soil. After the guns sounded, Richmonders' pride in their heritage was a goad to forbearance. Still, the city could not escape the transforming burdens of being a capital in the eye of a war. In every corner, life was quickly punctuated by the residue of strife. Groaning under the weight of refugees and the new Confederate bureaucracy, the city was often blighted with soot, noise, and darkness. Its once peaceful streets became centers of a garish nightlife. Thus came a rash of burlesque houses and saloons, all-night prostitution parlors, pawn shops, thieves, and fences. The streets themselves overflowed with trash, empty liquor bottles, squalor, and vagrants. And of course, there was the more tangible specter of war itself, the gnawing realization that Richmond was now on the frontier of the conflict, an inexorable dividing line between North and South. With a hostile force always at its back, each day, each month, each year, its residents faced the awesome prospect of being overrun by federal armies. But socially conscious Richmonders refused to be cowed. Amid the ever-increasing stress of total war, they danced, laughed, and somehow thrived. "There is good life in the old land yet," Mary Chestnut observed in 1864. "Go on, good people," wrote the Whig. "It is better to be merry than sad." For three precarious years, Richmond survived on savvy and sacrifice, indomitable will and sheer tenacity. In the face of hardship, hunger, and disease, its women stoically visited the hospitals and darned socks. As scarcity, impressment, and inflation ravaged the city, crowds still cheerily frequented the theaters, threw merry shindigs, and entertained one another in private gatherings and with intimate games of charades. When the roll of cannons and drum of musket fire could be heard in the distance, they stubbornly maintained their faith in Robert E. Lee, Jefferson Davis, and the cause. And as the noose tightened and mothers, wives, and children became pinched by hunger or were dying from broken hearts, Richmonders somehow pressed on. Was it all an element of self-delusion or stubborn patriotism toward their young country? Surely it was a bit of both. In 1864, Richmonders could console themselves with this sobering fact. The Confederacy's mighty Army of Northern Virginia had frustrated the designs and military careers of five separate commanders of the Union's Army of the Potomac. Indeed, most citizens saw their capital as an impregnable Gibraltar, and by 1865, if that winter had been particularly cruel, so had each previous winter. If morale was low, they knew that this was when Lee had always fought most brilliantly. In truth, each year and each spring, the war brought changes in Richmond's spirit, harboring rousing news of dangers and triumphs, from Fort Sumter to 7 days, Chancellorsville, the Wilderness, and Cold Harbor. But their bemused views of the privations of war were underpinned by a quiet confidence in a Southern victory. Grant had jabbed, bruised, and stretched Lee's lines. He had fought all summer and all winter, yet still Richmond had evaded him. Spring meant a renewed campaign for war, yet one more campaign in which Robert E. Lee might eventually prevail. Ironically, the more Richmond's fortunes declined, the more indignities it suffered at the hard hand of war, the more it found salvation in its new Confederate identity. By the time the Petersburg siege began, Richmonders had endured martial law, quelled a seditious bread riot, and survived conscription. They had withstood impressment of property and servants, bureaucratic ignorance and urban overcrowding, and they had survived startling underfeeding and horrendous casualties. And by this point, virtually every family, both the well-to-do and the humble, lived side by side with the shadow of death, as the graves of husbands, brothers, fathers, and sons littered the hillsides of the capital. In the spring of 1865, food was so scarce that many citizens were reportedly forced to eat dogs and even rats. Even this did not deter them. "We are all good scavengers now," quipped the redoubtable diarist J.B. Jones. "As long as we can hear a dog bark or a cat meow," roared preacher Ezra Stiles, "know that we will not surrender." Against all, Richmonders still rallied. In countless ways, this period represented some of the city's most stirring hours. "Once more," said one stoic Virginia maid, "we hugged to our bosoms the phantom of hope." In fact, the residents did more than that. While their comrades in Petersburg wandered through streets ducking and dodging federal missiles, balls and social events in Richmond flourished as perhaps never before. It was an amazing sight. Starvation balls became a rage. So did weddings. Church attendance rose. Buoyed by an evangelical fervor, believers flocked to St. Paul's for daily services in search to understand why God had chosen to punish them with such severity. They prayed for guidance and wrapped themselves in scriptures, telling of a wandering Israel, seeing the Jews as a prototype for their own nascent Confederate heritage. And more than ever, the first families held on to their Revolutionary War moorings as a way of bracing themselves for the trial now thrust upon them. Some also hoped they were living through a second Southern Revolution. One noted scholar, John Murren, has remarked that the Confederate national identity in 1861 was actually far stronger than any collective American national identity alive at the time of the Constitution. There is more than an element of truth to this. And from then on, a new sense of nationality, at once Southern and Confederate, had gathered in volume and strength as Richmonders confronted one of the most daunting armies the world had ever known. The rejoicing, the partying, the riding high on a cloud of euphoria and wishful thinking, the atavistic remembrances of the Revolution, the mystical examination of the Jews, all were merely part of a swelling belief that they were indeed forming a new nation. Their unanimity may be overstated, but there is little doubt that they were now a people united by a sense of common culture and a flickering, but nonetheless, real national spirit. Thus, Richmond was not in the spring of 1865 what it was in 1861, or for that matter, in 1776. And like Richmond, much of the Confederate South had also changed. Hardened and toughened by the privations of war, the South now had a very different conception of itself, its identity, and its purpose and reason. Nothing so captured the extent of that change as a debate that had raged for months in the capital city and beyond, from the port of Charleston in the trenches of Petersburg to the Tennessee backwoods and Louisiana bayous. The question was simply this: should the Confederacy emancipate slaves and muster them into the ranks of Southern soldiers? Before the guns had sounded over Fort Sumter, it would have been an unthinkable suggestion, a heresy of the highest order. But now, 4 years later, the South was asking precisely this. Driven in no small measure by the Confederacy's own desperation, by its dwindling resources, deaths, and desertions, and by an enemy who seemed to have inexhaustible supplies of material and men, this debate would culminate in one of the most momentous decisions of the Confederacy's life, in one of the most fascinating discussions in all of America's span. It would say much of what the South was and what it had become. The final debate would come to a head in March, shortly after Lincoln's second inauguration. And for Union and Confederacy alike, its implications were astonishing. About the last of August came in a Dutchman that sold us 20 niggers. John Rolfe, a Virginia colonist and soon-to-be husband of the Indian princess Pocahontas, recorded laconically in 1619. The first blacks to enter an English settlement in the New World, as indentured servants who could theoretically be freed in 5 years, their arrival marked the start of American slavery. The niggers were landed at Old Point Comfort, a sandy wedge that divided the James River from the broad stretch of the Chesapeake Bay. In ensuing years, American slave ships from the Yankee ports of New England, the birthplace of the abolitionist movement, would become a common sight on the Atlantic Ocean. Slaves, brought in Africa for £5 sterling, brought from 30 to 90 pounds in the West Indies, a sum that laid the footings for many a New England fortune. The colonies of Spain, Portugal, France, Holland, and Britain similarly became strongholds of slavery, and the institution flourished in the American North until 1780, when, beginning with Massachusetts and ending with New Jersey in 1804, the northern states one by one abolished bondage. It was hoped that the southern states would do likewise, especially in the cotton kingdom of the lower South, but there it stubbornly persisted. After Eli Whitney patented his famous cotton gin in 1794, plantations began to proliferate throughout the cotton kingdom, as did the corresponding rise in the demand for slaves. Over the course of 250 years, then, at first unwittingly, even reluctantly, slavery became so intertwined and intermixed with the fabric of the South, even though only one-third of Southerners owned slaves, that any assault on slavery was seen as an assault on Southern institutions, Southern values, and the very Southern way of life. From the late 18th century onward, the ferment over slavery only grew. The North was increasingly stung by the contradictions of its own struggle against Britain and the South's enslavement of others. The execrable sum of all villainies, in the defiant words of Reverend John Wesley. And slavery soon became a matter of deep conscience, particularly as the religious fervor of the Second Great Awakening swept the country. By the early to mid-19th century, reform was in the air. Year after year, with evangelic fervor, anti-slavery advocates kept scratching away with their pens and opening their mouths for freedom for people of all colors. And year after year, Southern politicians and Southern leaders bitterly fought back. Here, of course, was a classic formula for eventual conflict. Where many in the North, notably the abolitionists, clamored for the eradication of slavery, shall not our Lord in due time have these heathens also for his inheritance? Southerners clung ever more tightly to what they saw as the most treasured creed of Republican liberty, property rights, including slaves. Where the abolitionists, heirs of the Puritan notion of collective accountability, viewed slavery as the most heinous of all social sins, slaveholders stonily saw only economic ruin, social chaos, and racial war. Where abolitionists regarded slavery as evil against God's children, pure and simple, Southerners increasingly saw it as nature's positive good, the foundation for peace, prosperity, and racial comedy. And where abolitionists preached slavery as a violation against a higher law, Southerners angrily countered with their own version of the deity that it was sanctioned by the Constitution. In the vortex of this debate, once the battle lines were sharply drawn, moderate ground everywhere became hostage to the passions of the two sides. Reason itself had become suspect. Mutual tolerance was seen as treachery. Vitriol overcame accommodation, and the slavery issue would not just fade away. Yet by 1860, after decades of outspoken cries against slavery, this peculiar institution had been banned by all the European colonizers, had been eradicated in virtually all of Latin America, and was widely condemned by the Roman Catholic Church. It thrived only in Brazil, Cuba, and of course the American South and its border states. But to many Southerners, slavery was so intermingled with life below the Mason-Dixon line, with their independence, their institutions, and their social order, that on the eve of the Civil War, they would defiantly maintain, "Freedom is not possible without slavery, and we are either slaves in the Union or freemen out of it." When the war finally broke out, It was accepted with an insouciance and inevitability and even enthusiasm that is almost impossible to fathom today. Not surprisingly, once the South seceded and drew up a new constitution, unlike the Founding Fathers, it did not waffle on the matter of slavery, eschewing the tepid evasions over bondage found in the U.S. Constitution, persons held to service or labor. The Confederate Constitution outright called a slave, and guaranteed the protection of bondage in any new territory that the Confederacy might acquire. By the spring of 1865, then, on its surface, nothing seemed more ludicrous, or for that matter more treasonable, than to propose the arming of any of the 4 million slaves, approximately one-third of the South's population, to fight for their masters, let alone for their own emancipation. Indeed, after 1863, Jefferson Davis had denounced the North's Emancipation Proclamation and recruitment of slaves to fight for its side as the most execrable measure recorded in the history of guilty man. But nothing was sacred anymore, and wars have a way of transforming things. And in the dismantling of this tenet, it would be Davis himself, along with Robert E. Lee and a number of other prominent Southerners, who would lead the way. As early as 1861, however, some Southerners had already privately broached the matter of arming the slaves. "Our only chance is to be ahead of them, the Union," mused eloquent and discerning Mary Chestnut in December 1861. "Free our Negroes and put them in the army." Early in the war, a few daring Confederate voices had even openly urged making slaves into soldiers, but these random suggestions were regarded as heresy. But after the fall of Vicksburg and the defeat of Gettysburg, more iconoclasts were prompted to join the fray, wondering aloud whether the Confederacy might also tap this reserve of manpower. "We are forced by necessity of condition," lamented one Alabama editor with striking candor, "to take a step which is revolting to every sentiment of pride and to every principle that governed our institutions before the war. It is better for us to use the Negroes for our defense than that the Yankees should use them against us." An editor of the Jackson Mississippian was even more blunt. "Such a step would revolutionize our whole industrial system, but we must save ourselves from the rapacious North, whatever the cost." In truth, Southern blacks had already been playing a vital role in keeping the Confederate war machine alive. Slaves were used in great numbers to work as military laborers, freeing white males to fight. They also doubled as workers on the home front. Often at great danger to themselves, Southern blacks loaded, transported, and unloaded supplies. In the midst of exploding bombs and enemy gunshots, they dug trenches, erected barricades, constructed fortifications, and repaired and built roads, railroads, bridges, trestles, and tunnels. In between, they cooked and served food. Amid the marches and the fighting, they did back-breaking drudge work, washed uniforms, shined boots, mended clothes and tents, and moved ordnance. And, staggeringly enough, in Louisiana, some well-to-do free blacks outright rallied to the Confederate cause. Caught up in the general Southern view that hostile Northerners were bound and determined to force their way of life on the South, and looking for a more dignified role, they were allowed to form regiments of free blacks, serving as home guards to protect their state against invaders. In 1861, moreover, several other groups of black Southerners also offered themselves as soldiers to the Confederate War Department, only to be turned down. When black men offered to fight for Southern planter and Davis advisor James Chestnut, if he would only arm them, he responded tentatively, "One man cannot do it, the whole country must do it." On this matter, though, the slaveocracy of the South was still too entrenched and thus was content to dally, vacillate, and remain engrossed in other issues. Not so with the North. Lincoln's stunning twin measures of the Emancipation Proclamation and the arming of African Americans did more than strike a blow at the institution of slavery. They helped spur an estimated 1 million slaves to desert to the Northern side and added hardy troops to the war-weakened Union ranks in the last 2.5 years of the conflict. Indeed, at one point, the some nearly 180,000 black troops marshaled on the Union side were greater than the total number of men able to engage actively in combat for the Confederates. And in a number of important tests, the soldiers fought bravely. Witness the 54th Massachusetts Volunteer Infantry, which attained permanent glory with its assault on Fort Wagner in South Carolina. Or the 1st Kansas Colored, which won broad praise for 2 fierce engagements at Cabin Creek and Honey Springs in present-day Oklahoma. "I was never much for niggers," said one Wisconsin cavalry officer after the Cabin Creek engagement, "but bejesus, they are hell for fighting." By 1864, one highly regarded Southern general, Patrick Claiborne, was carefully assessing these stark developments. Once an Arkansas lawyer and considered the best division commander in both armies, the Irish-born Claiborne openly informed his fellow generals that the South should follow the North's example. With his firm-set lip, his erect bearing, and his regal gaze, he was, by all accounts, a rather eclectic warrior, fearless in battle. He had already been wounded 3 times. Forthright in manner, discerning in tactics, many called him the Stonewall Jackson of the West, and deeply passionate. He was also prepared to shake up the edifice of the Confederacy. And he did. The Emancipation Proclamation, he argued forcefully in a January 2, 1864 memorial presentation to corps commanders and General Joe Johnston's Western Army, had provided the enemy with a moral prerogative that rationalized his attempt at conquest. It had, he charged, rendered the slaves his friends, eroded the South's own security, and united Europe against the Confederacy. Therefore, Claiborne warned, "We are threatened with the loss of all we now hold most sacred." He then put the matter squarely. "As between the loss of independence and the loss of slavery, we assume that every patriot will freely give up the latter, give up the Negro slave rather than be a slave himself. To save all that they cherished, property, lands, homesteads, liberty, justice, safety, pride, manhood," he concluded that Southerners should transform the dreaded weakness of bondage into a source of strength, adding that they should recruit an army of slaves and guarantee freedom within a reasonable time to every slave in the South who shall remain true to the Confederacy. Claiborne's appeal was smartly tinged with realism. Ever since the agitation of the subject of slavery commenced, the Negro has been dreaming of freedom, and his vivid imagination has surrounded the condition with so many gratifications that it has become the paradise of his hopes. It was also shrewd politically. "The measure we propose," he added, "will strike dead all John Brown fanaticism and will compel the enemy to draw off altogether, or in the eyes of the world, to swallow the Declaration of Independence without the sauce and disguise of philanthropy. As for the slaves themselves, he mince no words, recalling the Helots of Sparta who stood their master's good stead in battle, and those brave galley slaves who had helped check the spread of Islam over Europe in the great sea fight of Lepanto. He maintained that not only would slaves fight for the Confederacy under such incentives, but that they would fight bravely. And Claiborne then went even further. Freedom should not be granted just to slave soldiers, but to the whole race that was loyal to the South." Such words would have horrified antebellum society. Yet these were not the musings of a private diarist or of men retiring to the comfort of their brandies after a warm meal, but the thoughts of a much respected officer on the front lines of the Confederacy's defense. In a remarkable departure from the past, 12 brigade and regimental commanders in Claiborne's division wholeheartedly endorsed his proposal. But if such replies were brave, they were also, at the time, calamitous. Most of the other generals eyed the proposal stonily, and their animosity toward it was palpable. "It was monstrous, painful, and startling," one division commander fired back, "revolting to Southern sentiment, Southern pride, and Southern honor." Another averred that it was "at war with my social, moral, and political principles." "We are not whipped and cannot be whipped," abhorred another. "Our situation requires resort to no such remedy." Touching on the very raison d'etre of the Confederacy, the debate was inflammatory, hot, furious, and on its surface even seditious. Fearful that it would cause discouragements and dissension, Jefferson Davis quickly stepped in and squelched the proposal, bluntly ordering the generals to stop even discussing the matter. But in the face of the South's increasingly gloomy prospects, the matter would not rest. Nor was it just a Southern concern. Tellingly, there were those in the North, such as the prominent intellectual Ralph Waldo Emerson, who as early as August 1862 deeply feared that the Confederacy might preempt the Union and adopt emancipation first. In so doing, he believed that the South would appear before the world as the champion of freedom, gaining recognition from France and England and putting the North in a disastrous position. Emerson's fears were hardly unfounded. Within months in the South, the issue did indeed come under serious debate. As early as 1862, and long before Patrick Claiborne's presentation, Congressman Warren Aiken, Speaker of the Georgia State Legislature and later a Confederate congressman, wrote, "It is a question of fearful magnitude." Yet Aiken, a slaveholder himself, now supported enrolling slaves as soldiers with the promise of emancipation. in September 1863, the Alabama legislature followed suit, recommending just that. And this was just the beginning. By mid-1864, Southerners now recognized that they might well have to make a choice between slavery on one hand and independence on the other. In fits and starts, the furious debate continued. That September, Henry Allen, the governor of Louisiana, declared that the time has come for us to put in the army every able-bodied Negro man as a soldier. A month later, the governors of six more states, meeting in a conference, urged a change of policy concerning the impressment of slaves for public service as required. However much this last clause may have constituted flaccid tiptoeing around the issue, the Rubicon had been crossed. The debate, bordering on flouting much of what the Confederacy stood for, became increasingly passionate. Then, on November 7th, Davis cautiously moved a step closer to arming the slaves, although